Hello and welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. I'm Holly Rubenstein. I'm a travel and entertainment journalist. And here each week, I'll be speaking to a very special guest about the seven chapters in their life's travel diaries. From their earliest childhood travel memory and the first place they fell in love with, to their hidden gem and what's at the top of their travel bucket list. We'll be uncovering their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. On today's episode, I'm so excited to be joined by the wildlife cameraman, Gavin Thurston. Gavin is a multi-BAFTA and Emmy winner, and over the last 37 years, he has worked on some of the most famous nature documentaries ever made, like Planet Earth and Blue Planet, most often working alongside Sir David Attenborough. Normally, Gavin spends most of the year travelling, and he has covered every corner of the globe, its deserts, polar ice caps, and its deepest sea. I'm sure you'll agree he is a fantastic raconteur, and so this had to be a feature-length long-haul episode. We talk about his incredibly close shave while filming gorillas in the Congo, what it's like to be the very first person to see and film previously undiscovered new species of wildlife, the terrifying time his submersible failed at 1,000 meters deep below sea level, and what it's like spending so much time working with the legend that is Sir David Attenborough. All that and much more coming up on The Travel Diaries. Gavin Thurston, welcome to The Travel Diaries. Thank you so much for joining me today. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you very much for asking me. Now, I looked down the list of your previous guests, and even if I'm at the bottom of that list, I'm extremely flattered that you've wanted to spend the time chatting to me today.
I have been so excited about this, like we've been discussing. I have so much that I am excited to ask you about. So, no, it's really my pleasure. And I've caught you in a rare moment when you're actually here in the UK, because how much of the year are you normally, in normal circumstances, travelling?
Well, I've been doing this job a long time as a wildlife cameraman, and I think over the last 28 years I've been freelance. I've been out of the country for probably 7 to 8 months every year.
Wow.
And this is the longest, well, because of this wretched COVID, it's the longest I've been home probably in the last 37 years. I've actually quite liked it, actually.
But you were one of the few that actually did then manage to get away and have a recording stint somewhere far flung.
Yes, I mean, dotted through last year, I had, I think, 10 days work between January and the end of October. Mm-hmm. And then I was fortunate enough to get away on a shoot that was planned to Tanzania. They claim not to have any COVID, but of course that's nonsense. But they've got less strict travel rules. So they let us Brits in. So I was away for 7 weeks filming there.
Must have felt nice to have a little bit of normality from a career perspective there.
Absolutely. I mean, otherwise, I'm self-unemployed, I think is the term. Just sitting at home, twiddling my thumbs. Yeah. It was great. I was out there in Tanzania, you know, amongst lions and hyenas. I can't say too much about the project, but it was great to get a bit of sunshine and see some open space and something different from my back garden. So I was very fortunate.
So we're going to take a journey through your life's travel diaries, and you've traveled so extensively, so there's so much to cover. But let's start first at the very beginning. That's chapter one, which is your earliest childhood travel memory.
Growing up, my parents got divorced when I was about two, but my mum was quite adventurous, and she used to take me and my sister off on camping trips. So I think some of my earliest memories were traveling in the UK, aged, I suppose, about 7, 8, 9, putting up tents in places like Durdle Door and, I don't know, down on the Devon coast. So my earliest memories are actually traveling in this country and living out of a tiny little mini. My mum had a mini Countryman estate, and she was very clever at packing. It's probably a skill I've partly inherited.
Yes.
I don't know if you're familiar with that game Tetris, where you try and fit all the blocks together.
Yeah.
Well, that was my mum with packing up the back of that mini, you know, for three of us with a tent and camping stuff, the cooking gear, food, sleeping bags, you name it. And that actually, those early skills, those early memories and those early skills I learnt have stand me in good stead through my career since, you know, putting up tents and packing cars and traveling.
And did a passion for photography come first, or a passion for wildlife? At what stage did this career unfold for you?
I suppose one thing that I find interesting is some people know what their passion is from an early age. So quite a lot of people in my industry will say, God, I've always loved wildlife. I always loved travel. You know, I always knew I wanted to be a wildlife cameraman, camerawoman, or producer or whatever. Mm. Whereas for me, I don't think I ever had a clear cut vision of where I wanted to be. The trigger for my passion for photography started when I was about 9. And I went on a school trip and we went up to Dudley Zoo up near Birmingham. I don't know if it's still there. And my kind Auntie Mary lent me her box brownie camera to take photographs on the day. And for those of you who don't know, for the listeners who don't know, box brownie was a film camera. Of course, they're rare nowadays. It was literally box-shaped. It would fit neatly in your hands. It would take a roll of film that would take 12 pictures. It was very, very basic. You just had a waist-level viewfinder, lens on the front, and literally all you did is point it at the thing you wanted to photograph and push the button on the side. There was no aperture or exposure or focus or anything to do. That was all fixed. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I went up for the day at the zoo, took a whole load of pictures, came back. And back in those days, you'd have to drop the film off at Boots, the chemist, or wherever to get it processed. And, you know, you'd go back 10 days, 2 weeks later and pick up your prints from the chemist. And after that day, I remember telling my mum, saying, God, it was amazing. We had a great day at the zoo and we saw elephants and giraffe and this, that and the other. And I said, but one thing, we saw this giant fish in a, you know, swimming pool leaping out of the water, touching its nose on a beach ball held by a keeper. And so when we went to pick up the pictures, I rummaged through them and the first photo was, I don't know, I think my feet out of focus on the doorstep or something. The next few photographs were some distant elephant and giraffe and stuff. But about the fourth or fifth photograph on the roll was this orca almost completely out of the water, touching its nose on a beach ball held up by a keeper. And I showed it to my mum. I said, see, there it is. There's that giant fish I told you about. And I think looking back now, it was that moment. And if you were sat with me now, I could show you that same photograph. It was taken in 1972. Mm. And I can show you that split second moment when that orca was almost completely out of the water. And it was then that I realized the power of photography. And it was interesting. The subject was something natural history. Well, unnatural, because mm-hmm. it was in a swimming pool. And we know now that orca should not be in captivity. And that thankfully is changing. But it was only later in life that looking back that I realized that was probably a pivotal moment that steered my whole career and the passion for photography.
And clearly you were a natural, because fast forward not too many years and you were flying around the world filming some of the most memorable nature documentaries alongside Sir David Attenborough. And is he a good traveller?
David is the best travel companion you could wish for, really. I mean, I've never worked with Michael Palin, so I don't know about him, but David is, you know, I say he's the best travel partner. He's never in a bad mood. He's got no airs or graces. He's got no demands. You know, if you're in a Land Rover, he'll travel in the Land Rover. If you're sleeping in a tent, he'll sleep in the tent. He's super knowledgeable. So if you're driving along and you see an amazing rock formation, you can say, oh, look, those rocks look nice. What are those? And then David will be able to give you an encyclopedic description of how old the rocks were, when they were laid down and what the folds were and so on.
Oh, amazing.
And obviously his knowledge of the natural world, of wildlife and plants and all the rest of it is superb. I say, if you were going to be in a pub quiz, if those ever exist again, you'd certainly want Sir David on your team, because he's so knowledgeable and just good fun.
Amazing. Well, chapter two then is the first place that you fell in love with. Where would that be?
Congo in Central Africa. This is the Republic of Congo, not DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo. And I think the reason I fell in love with it is, we've all heard of the Congo and we all know about Livingstone and Speke and those early explorers and the horrors that they suffered when they were first exploring there, trying to discover the source of the Nile or the Congo River and things. You know, many of them have died because of disease or being hunted by natives or attacked by animals and so on. So for me, there was a real sense of adventure when you mentioned the word Congo. So when I finally got to go there, and I think it was 1999, I was actually quite nervous. I mean, I said yes to the job, but even beforehand, I was nervous. I remember my granny telling me all those early horror stories. And so when we finally arrived there, it is still a wild place. It's amazing.
I imagine the journey to get there in itself is an adventure.
Yeah, I mean, yes, you're absolutely right. And I'm talking about a specific part of the Republic of Congo. It's a national park called the Nuabali Ndoki National Park, where I've spent many, many months. Back in the day when I first went there, it took us 6 days to get to location.
6 days, wow.
Yeah, so that was Bristol to London, London to Paris, Paris to Libreville, then a charter flight from Libreville to Wesso, and then Wesso, then it gets more intrepid. You travel along dirt streets and you get in a big dugout canoe with an outboard motor on it, and then you start chugging up the Ndoki River. And that's when you start to feel like those early explorers, you know, because you are traveling through thick jungle and you're seeing animals on the banks and you're seeing monkeys swing through the trees and, you know, tropical birds flying overhead like hornbills and things. And finally, you arrive at the steps of the WCS research place at Bamassa, which is the base for our expedition further into the forest. And it was amazing. I don't know if you've seen the film Apocalypse Now.
Not for many years.
But there's that moment in Apocalypse Now when they arrive at Colonel Kurtz's camp, and there's all these people stood there at dusk and they're holding flaming torches, and they climb up these, I think it's concrete steps up to these people. And arriving at Bamassa at dusk was just like that. At the top of the steps, you had these dark figures holding up lanterns, and it just felt so intrepid. And from there on, it just gets better and better. The next day, you then get in a smaller dugout canoe, which you call a pirogue, which you paddle and punt a bit like an Oxford punt, up these narrower streams, again through thicker and thicker jungle. And now you're starting to see signs of elephant and buffalo and so on, footprints and piles of dung, and the insect mass is starting to build, things buzzing around and biting you. And from there, you then get onto the path, and you travel by foot, and you follow the elephant path through the forest for another 6 hours or so to the camp. And there you are literally treading over piles of fresh elephant dung, and you're seeing flickers of birds flying through the trees, and you're getting all the smells of the forest, and you're hearing the cicadas, and you break into a sweat, and suddenly, you know, this is just like it would have been, well, in my mind, 200 years ago, those early explorers, and you really feel like you're discovering something for the first time. And so for me, the forests of northern Congo and central Africa are still intrepid, and you still, you know, even today, you can still feel like an explorer, and you still feel your life is on a knife edge in terms of what you might bump into. So for me, if anybody gets the chance to travel in the future, I can highly recommend going to that part of the world if you're feeling intrepid and you want an adventure. It's an amazing place.
And Congo is the first place that you fell in love with. Is there a particular animal that, when filming, really first captivated your imagination, or one that particularly surprised you?
Yes, and I think this is probably why I'm so fond of the Congo and Central Africa, is that particular first trip back in 1999 was to go and film Western lowland gorillas. And obviously I'd seen gorillas in zoos, but I'd never seen them in the wild before. So for those of you who don't know, and I didn't know at the time, but Western lowland gorillas are the most numerous of all the gorillas. I think, I don't know what the latest figures are, maybe around 100,000 or so in the wild. So the first time I saw those gorillas in the wild and started to film them, was hugely exciting. And I'm not a scientist. I didn't go to university. I didn't study biology or zoology or behavior or anything. So everything I've learned about bushcraft and animal behavior has been from scientists and fellow peers in the industry through my career. But the nice thing about working with something like gorillas is they're so similar to us in so many ways.
Yeah.
That you or I can read behavior into them. You can predict, you can kind of predict what they're going to do. You can predict whether they're angry or happy, or, you know, just from facial expressions or body posture. And so for me, that was quite engaging. Whereas if you look at something like a herd of wildebeest, they all look identical. You can't really tell if they're in a bad mood or not, unless they're charging at you, which is unlikely. But something like a gorilla, we can all read something into a primate. So for me, I think gorillas are right at the top of the list in terms of animals to go and film and spend time with. I think we have a lot of things in common with gorillas, and there's a lot of things we could learn from their animal societies, their lifestyle, I suppose.
And I did read that you once had quite a frightening encounter with a griller. It sounds like you had so many wonderful interactions with them, but I guess from time to time, they are unpredictable wild animals.
Yeah, I mean, I think generally wild animals are not out to do humans harm. They will generally only attack if threatened or persecuted or cornered or whatever. So this one example, it wasn't a malicious attack. So basically, again, Congo. So I was filming the Western Lona gorillas, and we'd set up a hide on the edge of a bye. And a bye is a open marsh and marshy clearing in the forest. This particular bye was about, I don't know, 300 or 400 meters long by about 60 meters wide. And basically, because it's marshy, there's no trees and you get different vegetation. So you get water lilies and, you know, reeds and so on. Any of the gorillas like to come and feed on those lilies and reeds. And they'll pull up the reeds like a stick of celery and chew off that white base, you know, the washam, pull off that white base bit and crunch it up. So it's a very good place to film the family as a whole, because you generally see the whole family, whereas in the forest, you might only see a few individuals at a time. So we set up this hide, sat in it for days and days and days, and got glimpses of gorillas. Anyway, eventually one day, a family of gorillas came in about 120 meters away, directly in line with the hide, which was great. And they started to come in and feed. And I think there was about 16 or 17 in the group, including a big silverback. And this was really exciting, having spent all that time waiting. So finally, I was getting these amazing images of gorillas feeding and the babies playing and the mothers suckling the babies and all sorts of things. And slowly, this group of gorillas, the family gorillas, worked their way towards the hide. And they were just ambling, getting closer and closer. And I was picking off the various shots. And eventually, they got so close that one of them caught a glimpse of the reflection in the lens, a female, and she barked. She did this alarm bark at me. And so I froze. And I was thinking, shit. Anyway, so I kept the camera really still. And eventually, when all the heads were down again, I moved the camera and picked off a few more shots. And then another female saw the lens and barked again. Now the silverback was looking interested, thinking, you know, what's that in the forest, you know, going to attack my family? So this is 200 kilos of silverback. He's a big protective dad. He's going to protect his family. Anyway, slowly, I stopped filming. I locked the camera off. So slowly, some of the gorillas drifted into the forest and worked their way behind the hide. And I could hear them moving through the foliage. And the others drifted down towards the hide. And eventually, the silverback sat about, I don't know, 20 or 30 feet from the hide. And he sat with his back slightly to the hide. And by now, my heart was racing and I was thinking, shit, just move on, which is not what you'd expect from a wildlife cameraman. You'd think I'd be excited, but I was actually really nervous. Now, one of the things with filming with gorillas is they teach you that if you're on a path and you meet gorillas on a path when you're walking, there's a certain behavior you can do. And that is, you don't want to threaten the gorillas because you're going to get beaten up. So what you do is just drop down on one knee, pick a leaf and just pretend to eat. Don't look at the gorillas, don't look them in the eye. And just, you can make this low submissive call, a sort of just a calming call, which is a this low grunt, which is like a contact call the gorillas do.
Right.
So that's if you meet a gorilla. So you can show just from body language, you're not being threatening, you're just sitting down, you just happen to have bumped into a family of gorillas. However, there's no protocol that if you're hiding in a hide in a fake bush and a gorilla sees you, what the hell do you do? It can't see you, so you can't shut your eyes and turn away slightly or drop on one knee because it can't see you. Anyway, so this is it going through my mind. Also, to complicate matters, I'd been reading a book in the hide called Gorillas in the Mist by Diane Fossey. And in that book, just because I thought it was topical to read it whilst filming gorillas, but in that book, she describes how difficult it was to get researchers to come and work with her and stay there because when you get charged by a 200 kilo silverback, some of these researchers would literally shit themselves. It is so frightening to have an animal come charging at you and stop inches from your face.
Yeah.
It's truly frightening. So she was explaining that in a book and it just refreshed my memory about how frightening these can be.
How precarious the situation you were in.
Yeah. And the other thing in this book, she describes that over her time there, she found something like, I don't know, I can't remember now, 70 skulls of different gorillas, mostly females. And of those skulls, most of them had puncture wounds in the skull. And she reckoned this was from where silverbacks had, the males had grabbed the females to discipline them. But and obviously punctured their skull with their teeth. I don't know if you've been in a museum and seen a gorilla skull, but it's about, a centimetre thick.
Enormous.
And if you see a human skull, it's a bit like an eggshell by comparison.
Yeah.
So all this was racing through my head with the silverback sat so close to the hide. I was thinking, shit, if he just leaps on the hide and bites me, my head's going to burst like a ping pong ball. I mean, I'm toast. Anyway, thankfully, he eventually got up and he walked past the hide and carried on down the by. And I was thinking, God, thank God for that. Anyway, as he got further from the hide, I thought, oh, that's quite a nice shot, actually. So I very carefully picked up the Cameron tripod in the hide and I was just turning it round to poke it out through the other hole of the hide. And he stopped and his back foot was just hovering off the ground. And he was you could see he was thinking. And he looked back over his shoulder at the hide and he started walking straight back to the hide. And I was just thinking, no. And he got closer and closer. And I just cowered down in the hide. And literally my heart was beating like crazy. I could barely breathe. And I was really, really frightened. He came right up to the hide and I saw his shadow on the hide. And the next thing, he just whacked the hide with his hand. It hit me across the back, knocked me to the ground, knocked me off this little stool. And now I was cowering under the tripod thinking, shit, this is it. This is it. And I could see his shadow hovering by the hide. I was just waiting for 200 kilos of silverback just to pummel me to a pulp. I tried to make this low appeasement, this low noise.
Yeah.
And I just went like this and made this tiny whimper. I was just so frightened. Anyway, he just walked off.
Oh,
and he probably thought all along, he's probably thinking, what is that strange bush? He came over, whacked it, gave an exploratory whack. He heard this mouse inside and then just walked off. but I was left badly bruised for several days across my kidneys.
Imagine. Oh, gosh. What an experience.
Looking back, it's fine. But at the time, I was absolutely shit scared, to be honest. Absolutely shit scared.
And is that something that... is that a risk that you are constantly weighing up as a wildlife cameraman? How much danger, not danger, but how close to get, I suppose, and how much to push it, because you then wanted that last shot because it's just so tempting when he was walking away.
Yeah.
So are you constantly analysing risk in that respect?
Yeah, I suppose you are. I mean, I've been bitten by one snake and that was actually holding one in captivity. I've never been bitten by a single animal in my whole career of 37 years.
And that's pretty amazing.
I've been bitten by lots of ticks and had blood sucked by leeches and mosquitoes and God knows what else. But I've never been actively attacked or bitten by any animal other than that slap from a gorilla. So maybe I'm good at assessing risk or maybe I've been very lucky. Mm. But I think overall, I don't think animals are malicious. I don't think they're out just to beat the shit out of you or bite you for the hell of it. I think they would only do it in defense as a last resort. Whereas humans are very different. Humans are malicious and humans can be cruel and humans will torture other humans. And so humans are a very different beast.
Mm.
But generally across the animal kingdom, I think most animals are, they're not out for trouble. They're not out to just beat you up for no reason.
Yeah.
But yeah, going back, sorry, I'm waffling on, but
that's fascinating.
I suppose the whole time you are assessing risk, you know, how close should you walk to an elephant or a rhino or a lion or whatever it might be. To be honest, most of the time what you're trying to do is you're trying to film natural behavior. And as soon as an animal knows you're there, unless it's an animal used to, say, tourist vehicles or something, that behavior will change and it will either, well, generally the animals run away because they've been so persecuted by man. So generally you're trying not to be spotted and you're trying not to get close.
Mm.
And that means actually generally not taking a risk. Because if you get seen, then you'll probably blow the behaviour you're trying to film.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the genre of television. There are types of TV where presenters want to run up and grab things. That's not the kind of TV I'm interested in, to be honest. Man conquering everything. And if you take somebody like Steve Irwin, he did amazing good for conservation and an awareness and instilling a passion about wildlife in so many of his viewers. But for me, it was kind of the wrong message or a mixed message, because it was always about man conquering animals. Mm. You know, it doesn't matter how venomous or dangerous, he could grab it. And it's a shame, because for me, that ultimately is the wrong message. We should be living side by side with wildlife and not conquering it all.
Mm. Yeah, very good
But that's
point.
A different genre of TV.
Yeah. Well, so moving on to chapter three then, that is the place where you learned the most about yourself. Where would that be?
Oh, blimey. Probably, I've been in a few tricky situations. And when you're tested, beyond the gorilla situation, when you're tested, you find out who you really are. And I suppose one of those situations was I worked on a series called Blue Planet 2, and I was fortunate enough to film pretty much all of Program 2, which was about the deep. So I got to spend hours and hours and hours and hours, more than 500 hours in a submersible that can go to 1,000 metres under the ocean. And it was amazing. Well, first of all, I wondered whether, you know, when I was offered the job, I agreed and leapt at the chance. You know, I'd never been in a submersible before. But actually, when it came down to getting into it, the first shoot was off the west coast of Australia, off the Barrier Reef. And it took us about 2 days chugging out on the ship, the Alusha, to get out to the, you know, the place where we were going to dive.
To even get out there, 2 days.
Yeah, even get out there. And on that whole journey, of course, the sub team were building the sub and adjusting lights and fitting the cameras and charging the batteries and air tanks and so on. And of course, being a newbie, I wasn't allowed anywhere near any of that stuff. Yeah. But it gave me 2 days of thinking and looking at this sub. And it's basically a sphere which is about 6 foot diameter. It's 9 inch thick acrylic. So a perspex sphere in a kind of a metal frame. And it's got a hatch you get into at the top.
Only 6 foot?
Yeah. And there's three of us in there.
Oh,
for up to 10 hours at a time. You've got life support for 10 hours. And during those 2 days, I was thinking, bloody hell, what happens if we get all the way out there and I get into that sub and they close that lid and I freak out?
Yeah, that's the first thing I was thinking. I was thinking, well, that would give me a panic attack for sure, the pressure.
Well, exactly. I had 2 days to think about that. I was committed to doing the shoot now. And I thought, God, this is going to be so embarrassing if I'm just sat on the deck for 3 weeks because I can't sit in that sub. Thankfully, when we finally dived in it, I got in it, shut the door. Well, not me, but they shut the hatch. We got wheeled to the back of the ship and we got lowered into the water. It's so peaceful once you're underwater. It's suddenly, you know, you're away from all the noise of the ship. Suddenly there's silence and you start to sink down through the water past all these amazing creatures. And for me, I never panicked once. I never had any thoughts of claustrophobia or, you know, because once you're in there, you can't get out until you get out of the, you know, until the sub's brought out the water.
And how long does it take to get down to the point where you're filming as well?
Obviously, you see stuff on the way down and you see stuff mid-water. You see amazing, you know, squid and marlin and octopus and krill and, you know, I mean, there's so many things you see down there that I have no idea what they are, to be honest.
Yeah.
But it takes you about an hour. So the bottom limit for that particular craft is 1,000 meters, so a kilometer down, and it takes you about an hour to drift down to that level. And on the journey down, obviously, as you leave the surface, the light starts to fade. For a start, once you get to about 10 meters, pretty much all the red light is filtered out, so you're in this blue world. And as you sink further, as you get towards 200 meters, it starts to get dark. And at 300 meters, even on a bright sunny day, to our eyes it's dark. Obviously, there's creatures down there which can see in that darkness. But to our eyes, it's dark at 300 metres. And then, obviously, you put the submersible lights on and then you sink further. But you're sinking then through, you know, effectively black water. And eventually you get to the bottom. Or, you know, if you're diving where the sea bottom is at 1,000 metres, and then you go into a whole different world. It is like being on a different planet.
Yeah.
And every dive we went on, you know, it would either be myself, the producer and the sub-pilot, or sometimes the producer would swap out for a scientist to sit in the passenger seat. And on some of the dives with the producer and the sub-pilot, we'd see these weird things. We kept seeing the same things. So next time we went down with a scientist, I'd say, oh, you see that thing there? I said, well, what is that? And the scientist would peer out of the submersible at this weird creature. And what was really heartening is he would say, I have no bloody idea. And there would be things we would see on dives where, the scientists had no idea what they were. They would say, it might be one of these or might be one of those, but I've never seen anything like it. So it was, there was a real sense of adventure and exploration, the fact that we were seeing species probably nobody's ever seen before or described before.
Yeah, and they're filming them for the first time.
Yeah, absolutely. It's and actually still 95% of the ocean is still unexplored.
I was going to ask you, so how much do you think is still out there? How many new species are there out there, do you think, deep in those dark depths that we've never seen before?
I think there'll be tens of thousands of
really?
New species.
Wow.
So so forget going to Mars. If you're a young explorer and you want to have adventure and discover something, forget all that effort of getting into space. Just literally go a kilometre underwater. It sounds easy, I know, but go a kilometre underwater and you will see things nobody's ever seen before that you'll be able to describe, and there'll be behaviours you've never seen before.
They're particularly weird as well. I remember that series, and some of those deep sea creatures are really, really odd and captivating to look at.
Yeah, I mean, I reckon, I was trying to describe it to somebody, I reckon if you took all the Disney animators and you gave them LSD and told them to draw weird deep sea creatures, they would not come up with some of the creations you see for real down there.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact. You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Going back to your original question about where did I find out more about myself, on one of the expeditions, we were off the Costa Rica coast and we were there to film Yeti crabs. And these are crabs which are only discovered, I think, in 2006 or 2009. And they're called Yeti crabs or Hoff crabs after David Hasselhoff with his hairy chest.
Really?
Yeah, because they've got really hairy claws, you know, really hairy claws.
Yeah.
And what they do is they live on methane seeps at the bottom of the ocean. And there's very little that grows at a methane seep apart from algae. So what these crabs have evolved to do is they've got all these hairs on the arms, on their, I could say arms, on their claws. And what they do is they hold their claws in the stream of methane bubbles coming out of the ocean floor and they wave them around and they farm the algae on their, on the hairs on their claws. And then they bring the claw in and, you know, munch all the algae off their claws. So that's what we were there to film. So it was a 3-day shoot. So we chugged off the coast, got in submersible, went down to 1,000 metres. We got straight onto the same methane seep that was discovered in 2009, 2006, whenever it was. And we got on filming. Now, when we dive in the submersibles, we have two submersibles. So you always have one as a backup. So if we say to get caught in, I don't know, deep sea fishing net or something, the other submersible would be able to snip us out with its manipulator and rescue us. So we dive down with two submersibles. And the other good thing about having two submersibles as a cameraman is you can use the other one as a very expensive, elaborate lighting stand. So you can position that, you know, to backlight these crabs. So you see the, you know, the light through the hairs on their arm, on their claws. Anyway, a few hours into the dive, the other submersible had an issue, a technical issue, so had to return to the ship. But it was deemed safe for us to stay down, get the job done, and then return to the ship. So we were down for about 7 or 8 hours, I think, in this tiny submersible, and getting amazing footage of these crabs. And eventually, you know, we pushed it because we heard that the weather was coming in for the next few days. So there was little chance of us being able to dive again the next day or the day after. So we had to try and get a complete sequence in that one dive. So we kind of pushed, you know, pushed it to the limit of what we could do in terms of staying down there. Anyway, over the last hour or so, normally what you do is you call up to the ship and say, you know, I can't remember the call sign now, but you say, this is Nadir, you know, SO, this is Nadir. So to the surface officer, just to say, we're alive, we're okay. And you'd give them the readout of your CO2 and your battery levels and so on, just to show that you're compos mentis and everything's fine.
Yeah.
Anyway, about an hour before the end of the dive, we lost comms with the ship. Anyway, we thought, well, that's right. So basically the pilot would just call in every half an hour and just say, here's an update, CO2, you know, rising, but still okay. We're just going to finish filming, then we're going to return. Anyway, so finally we thought, right, okay, we've got to go back up to the surface. And I was looking across at the screen and I could see the CO2 level had now gone to orange. So it was kind of telling us we've got to get up. So he called to the surface, permission to surface. Of course, no reply because we couldn't hear the ship. Anyway, so I started stowing the cameras and packing stuff down in the sub. I looked over my shoulder and the pilot was kind of behaving erratically. And I thought, I said, is everything all right? And he said, well, no, nothing's working. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, none of the valves are working. So normally there's two valves you turn to the front and then there's another two valves you open. That blows the tank, fills it up with air, and then you float to the surface. Mm-hmm. And I could see the CO2 was rising. So I said to him, you know, and having been a diver for many years, I realised you can get like narcosis, or you can get weird effects if the air you're breathing isn't normal air.
Right. Yeah.
So I said, what do you normally do then? And he said, yeah, switch these two to the front, these two to the top, and that would blow the tank. And that's exactly what we'd been taught to do if he was incapacitated. I said, okay, if that doesn't work, what do you do? And he says, well, I turn to the other side and these auxiliary tanks, you turn those two and blow those two, but nothing's happening. And I could see just a hint of panic in his eyes, which, of course, is infectious. And then I looked to Will, the assistant producer, and he, too, was very wide-eyed and slightly ashen white. And I said, OK, if those don't work, what do you do? And anyway, he tried calling to the surface again, nothing. And I said, OK, why don't you switch off? The whole thing runs on a Windows tablet, believe it or not. I said, why don't you switch that off and switch it on again? You
know, that typical switch IT off solution. And switch it on again.
Yeah. So he switched it off, rebooted it. Still nothing. He did it again, switched off, rebooted it, nothing. And then I heard him say the fateful words on the radio, X-ray, X-ray, X-ray. And basically, as soon as I heard him say X-ray, I thought, shit, this is it. I felt sick to my stomach. And I didn't think I was going to die down there because the other sub could have come down and rescue us. And there's lots of safety backups beyond that initial thing. But the fact that he called X-ray, X-ray, X-ray.
Is X-ray like Mayday?
Yeah, Mayday, Mayday, Mayday. It's a clearer, on some of those radios, it's clearer to say X-ray because you've got diction to it.
Right.
I looked up to Will. Now he was ashen white and wide-eyed and clearly not comfortable he'd heard that either. And I was thinking, shit, shit, shit. And I knew that basically every time they dive in those subs, they will also know where the nearest rescue sub is. So we were about a 3-day sail from San Diego, and that's where another one of the rescue subs is. So basically what they could have done, if we were in real trouble, they can call San Diego and say, please send a rescue sub. So all I knew, the worst that was going to happen is we were going to be stuck on the bottom in the dark without, you know, much food for up to 4 days. So 4 days is the maximum you can survive in those submersibles, but submersibles, you know, three of you sat in that 6-foot sphere for 4 days would not be a fun experience.
No.
Just waiting for lights to appear out of the gloom for somebody to rescue. Anyway, after switching off, switching on again, eventually everything just came on and worked fine. And
he was able
to blow the tanks. Yeah, and eventually we were slightly stuck in the mud. So we rocked the sub inside, you know, like if you get a car stuck, we were all rocking side to side. And eventually we freed from the bottom and we made it back to the ship okay. But it was interesting how I've never been in that situation that slowly evolved, where you could slowly see a disaster unfolding. And it's interesting to see how I reacted, that I was actually, although I felt pretty scared, I was actually kind of quite calm about it and was able to think it through clearly. And I knew ultimately I had that belief that we would solve it, you know, if we didn't get it fixed. We had the other sub that could rescue us, and we had a rescue sub in San Diego if needed. And of course, it never came to any of that. It just turned out, actually, it was an IT thing that, of course, we had our iPhones with us in the sub just for taking happy snaps and things. And it turned out that what was happening is our iPhones were connecting onto the submarine submersible Wi-Fi. And it was blocking it from connecting to the hatch switch to tell the computer that the hatch was closed. Which is why. So after that, we learnt, put your
leave your phones on the
airplane
boat.
Mode. Well, put it in airplane mode.
Wow, what an experience. Well, moving on to chapter 4, that is your all-time favourite destination. Now, this is going to be hard because I know that you've been, is it over 80 countries that you've visited over the years?
Yes, and saying I've been to over 80 countries used to be kind of a badge of honour, but now with climate change, it's almost a shameful admission. Admittedly, it's been filming wildlife and hopefully stories which will empower and passion, you know, viewers to care more about the natural world. But as I say, it's no longer a badge of honour to say over 80 countries.
It's a tricky one, isn't it? Because I know exactly what you mean. And of course, we're being so much more mindful of that now more than ever. And then, you know, working in the travel industry and with 1 in 10 people working in it and how much they're struggling and suffering because of COVID, it also means that I want people to travel again as soon as they are able to. So it's this really hard kind of balance to strike in terms of how is best to travel.
It is. I mean, my whole career has been based on travelling around the globe. As I've been to the North Pole and South Pole and most places in between. And, you know, and I love the adventure of it. But as I say, it comes with, you know, I mean, there's a responsibility now. Now we know the damage we're doing to the planet. There's a responsibility to know that if you are going to travel, do it in a environmentally as possible way. Try and offset your carbon. I mean, I do a lot of tree planting now. Well, not a lot, but whenever I see acorns, I'll pick them up and plant them in pots.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that by planting those little oak trees, that ultimately over the next few hundred years will offset the carbon that I've produced, you know, in my travels. So there are ways of doing it. And also, hopefully in the future, we'll have, you know, more efficient cruise ships or electric planes or, you know, there will be ways of reducing, you know, allowing us still to travel without the same impact, hopefully.
Yeah.
But yes, your question, favourite place in the world. Well, I think my three favourite places, one I've already mentioned is Congo. Second is Sumatra. And the third is Alaska. And I'll explain why. Those three places have something in common, and that is they're all wild, still wild, wild places. So, for instance, if let's take Alaska, because that's probably the most accessible. You may have heard of Katmai National Park in Alaska. There's a little part just north on the northeast side of Katmai National Park called Hallow Bay. And I've been fortunate enough to spend many, many months there filming the brown bears, grizzly bears there, coastal brown bears.
How wonderful.
You know, doing what they do, hunting salmon and things. And what's really nice about that part of the world is you're doing everything on foot. It's not like going on safari in Kenya where you sit in a jeep and get driven around all these things. You're on foot. You're up close and personal with these big, charismatic animals. And, you know, these bears will, again, they're not out to harm you. They're not out to kill you and eat you. They're out to catch salmon and do what they normally do. And if you behave in the right way and you go with, you know, with guides who are sensitive to that, it's perfectly safe and to sit at the edge of a river, you know, 20 foot back from the edge of a river, and have these 800 kilo animals hunting within 6 or 8 feet of you, chasing after salmon up and down. And that, that's kind of how it should be, really, us living side by side with animals rather than displacing them or scaring them off or whatever.
Yeah.
So that particular corner of Katmai National Park, Hallow Bay.
What's the landscape like there? How does it look?
So you've got, obviously, you've got the coast on one side. You've got the Shelikof Straits, which I believe are one of the most dangerous stretches of water in the world. You get, you know, ripping currents. You get freezing cold temperatures. And then as you come inland, you've got these amazing sort of sandy beaches, dark, like a volcanic sand, because that whole area is volcanic. Mm-hmm. It's usually littered with driftwood, you know, giant washed up trees from the timber industry, which have been weathered by storms and so on. Then you've got kind of tussock grass. And then shortly behind that, the land starts to rise up to mountains. And those mountains have got snow on for most of the year. The snow disappears for a couple of months in the summer. So it's a really rugged landscape. Mm. And then you've got these rivers that go inland, which is what the salmon swim up every year for their spawning ritual.
Yeah.
And that's what brings so much wildlife in. So the bears come for those 2 or 3 months of the year when the salmon are running, because that's when they get most of their feed. You'll get wolves hunting alongside the bear, again, chasing salmon or picking up the scraps. You'll get foxes. I think in one day I saw, in terms of seeing charismatic animals on foot, up close, we saw coastal brown bears, wolves, elk, moose, beavers. There's a beaver dam just inland that you can walk up to, and you can get very close to the beavers, and they'll, you know, eye level. If you stand below the dam, they'll swim close and come and slap their tails at you. Then you get rafts of hundreds of sea otters off the coast. They're all sort of floating on their backs, eating their, you know, the clams or whatever it is they're eating. Bald eagles flying overhead. It's kind of like a North American Eden, really, where you've got all these animals living side by side. But as humans, you're able to be in amongst them without them all being, you know, scared and running away if you behave in the right way. So it is it's a magical place to go if you love the wild places and you love the wild animals. That's, you know, Hallow Bay or Katmai National Park in Alaska.
Oh, sounds glorious. Firmly added to my travel bucket list.
Excellent.
And how about Sumatra? Why do you love that so much?
Sumatra, again, it's an intrepid place to visit. You've still got wild bits of forest, not as much as there should be. But if you go up to Kerinci Sablat, there's an active volcano there. You've got, you know, hot springs. You've got rugged, intrepid rivers to cross with rope bridges and things. But again, the key thing there, the prize for me, is you've got this charismatic wildlife. So you've got Sumatran tiger. I mean, I think there's only about 300 or 500 of those left in the wild.
And you were the first person to capture one of them on film?
Yeah, absolutely. They'd been captured on stills camera traps before, but nobody had captured them on video. And we were able to do that for a series called Deep Jungle. So we spent 4 weeks out there setting camera traps and, you know, just filming conventionally. So you have Sumatran tiger. Mm-hmm. You've got clouded leopard. You've got bears. A whole host of primates, gibbons and all sorts. I mean, and all this is you're on foot, you're up close and personal, you're walking the animal trails, you're seeing footprints, you're seeing the scat, you're smelling all the wildlife. You can, you know, it's a whole host of birds and things. It's just a wildlife haven, really. Although, you know, it is shrinking, but it is a wildlife haven, an intrepid place to visit.
You've mentioned many times in the chat about the environments that you're filming in and visiting shrinking. And this is obviously something that is highlighted in A Life on Our Planet, which I rewatched again last night. It's a Netflix documentary that came out during the first lockdown, did it?
Yes, it was due to launch at the Royal Albert Hall in April last year. And of course, that was delayed, which is a real shame. But it got then launched, I think, in August. So yes, it's on Netflix, David Attenborough, Life on Our Planet.
An incredible look at the monumental scale of humanity's impact on nature. And at the end, we see these two scenarios play out, don't we, where there's one that's incredibly harrowing and bleak, one of an increased population, of increased temperatures and natural disasters and habitats being devastated. And then on the other, there's a more hopeful possibility, one of rewilding of the wilderness and positive changes that are being made by countries. You show Costa Rica as an example of a country that is making a tangible difference. So kind of from your experience, and these films obviously I know take a while to put together and make. So now at this stage here in 2021, where are we at? Which countries are leading the way with this? Who can we take example from?
As you say, Costa Rica is probably a prime example where they've just set aside a large portion of the country to be national parks, so sanctuaries for wildlife. And it's paying dividends because, admittedly, in the tropics, nature bounces back quickly, quicker perhaps than, the northern or southern extremes. But what's interesting is a lot of Costa Rica's economy is based on tourism. You know, people are coming to see the amazing wildlife they've got and the amazing habitats they've got. So you might think it's kind of wasted land if you're not growing crops on it or whatever, but I think the land is way more valuable in Costa Rica to have tourists coming year after year than it is to, say, have a banana plantation. I mean, you need a mix of things, but I think it is paying dividends. So Costa Rica is leading the way in that respect. Lots of countries are doing lots of great things. I think we're just not doing enough and we're not doing it fast enough. Yeah. I mean, it's amazing, you know, you're in the travel industry and I'm sure a large portion of people who travel want to go and see palm trees on pristine beaches or go and see elephants in the savannah or lions hunting or whatever. It's amazing the draw that wildlife and those wild places have. And I think even on a small scale at home, I can't remember who I was talking to last year, but I was saying, isn't it amazing that people in their offices in London in the summer, you know, they've got their sandwiches for lunch. So rather than sit at their desk, they'll take their sandwiches and just go and sit in the park for half an hour and go and lie on the grass in the sun. So people naturally gravitate towards these, towards nature and greenery and open space and big skies. And I think we all have an innate connection to the natural world. We all want to visit those wild spaces. We all want to see pristine habitats. You know, you're never going to go and want to see, a rubbish tip or something. You know, it's not going to be a relaxing place to go and sit. So I think as countries that, you know, I think a lot of countries recognise there is value, financial value, because obviously a lot of the time it comes down to money. But there is a financial value in having these wild spaces and wild animals, native animals that people want to see.
I couldn't recommend more to tune into A Life on Our Planet on Netflix with David Attenborough and with Gavin as the director of photography. A must watch for everyone interested in the future of our planet, really.
No, well, thank you very much. Yeah, thank you for that plug. And I would say the nice thing is it's David Attenborough's witnessed 94 years on this planet. So he's seen firsthand how it was when he first started traveling, how humans have basically screwed it up. But also humans are ingenious. We have all the solutions. We have all the ways of fixing it. And so that film, although in the middle, maybe it's a bit depressing, it gives me hope that we can actually, mend the errors of our ways.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So moving on to chapter 5, that is your hidden gem. Can you tell me a bit about a place that you've been to that many of our listeners might not have discovered yet or have heard of?
Again, I kind of feel slightly guilty encouraging, painting this picture of somewhere and trying to encourage people to go and travel to it because,
they're not able to travel there now anyway, so they're travelling from their armchairs.
Yeah. But a place I've been lucky to travel to a few times is Antarctica.
Oh, wow.
It's the most beautiful, pristine habitat. It's massive. Again, obviously, I didn't pay attention at school because I remember at school them saying, Antarctica is a continent and the North Pole is frozen ocean. But it was only when I went there, I think in my early 30s or mid-30s, that I put two and two together and realised, oh, yes, Antarctica is mountains and rocks and all the rest of it. And the North Pole is literally just a frozen layer of ice on the ocean. Mm-hmm. The nice thing about Antarctica is it's not built up. Man hasn't yet trashed it. I mean, there are I think pretty much every nation is represented there with research stations.
Yeah.
But these are tiny little dots on a massive continent. But as a continent, it's just beautiful. It's pristine, clean white lines. It is like a different planet, really. So I've been there a few times, and you've got loads of life around the ribbon edge of Antarctica. So, you know, you've got all those penguin and seal colonies and so on, and whales visiting and things. But as soon as you go inland, you know, just a few miles, it is completely barren.
Yeah.
And then there's nothing all the way to the South Pole. You know, I suppose the nearest from the coast to the South Pole is about 800 miles, I think. But in that interior, there's nothing living. There's nothing at all. And there's something quite... I don't know, there's something quite nice about that you've got these huge areas of land where, well, nothing can live. So it's almost like Earth's got its own little area, which is fenced off that man can't go and trash, hopefully. So as long as we continue to have the Antarctic Treaty and, you know, everybody doesn't rush down there and start mining for minerals and things, it probably will be one of the last places, truly wild places on Earth. But it's beautiful, absolutely beautiful place to see.
I imagine it's so peaceful.
It is. Once you're, I think it's very different because probably most people who would visit would have to travel down on a ship, on a cruise ship or something. So you've always got you're always with other people and you've always got the noise of that. Admittedly, you can do these shore trips where you get closer and you'll, you know, the sound of a distant ship might be drowned out by the sound of penguins and birds and things. Mm. So you can experience that wildness when you get ashore. Yeah, there's something beautiful about just hearing the sound of wind through ice and rocks and things.
So in contrast, chapter 6 is your worst travel experience. What do you remember for the wrong reasons, potentially?
It's funny because looking back now, I look back very fondly, but at the time it was hell on earth. And that was when I worked on a series called Realms of the Russian Bear. And I traveled to then what was the Soviet Union. That was before Glasnost. So this was, 1990, something like that.
Yeah.
And the Soviet Union was not necessarily a great place to travel to back then. You know, it was, there was very little food. It was difficult to get hold of fresh food. We were staying, it was right down on the Afghan-Iranian border where we were, which is now Turkmenistan, which I've been back to since and is an amazing country to visit.
Really?
Yes, it's still under a dictatorship of sorts, and the people are persecuted. Let's not get too political, but it's not a great place to live necessarily, but it's a great country that's got, you know, a lot going for it. So I went there back in the early 90s, and we went right down onto the Afghan-Iranian border to a small reserve called Badkhiz. And there they've got all sorts of things. They've got, you know, leopard and steppe cat and kulan and, you know, antelope, and historically they would have had cheetahs there. It's a really rugged landscape. It gets super, super hot in the summer. So I think it's the hottest place I've been on the planet.
Really?
There are hotter places, but I think we had temperatures of up to 54 degrees centigrade.
If
you're camping, I mean, if you think Glastonbury's bad and you wake up with a hangover at 30 degrees, try it at 54 degrees. It's dangerously hot. So my memories of that, my first trip there was actually at the end of the winter, early spring. And because it's desert, I assumed it was going to be shorts and T-shirt. But I was very, very wrong. We got there, it was snow on the ground, it was -6. We had to draw water from the well. The well was frozen. We'd have to put a rock in the metal bucket and drop it to try and break the ice every morning to get water. It was bloody freezing cold at night. I had an adequate sleeping bag from Millets rather than some proper expedition thing. So I do, and I remember being ill, and it was a long drop toilet. So, you know, every time you needed to go to the toilet, you know, you'd have to run out in the freezing cold and go and squat over a hole in a few planks, you know, which is opened on one side, and the villagers would just come and stare at you when you're squatting on the toilet and things. Now, I've got, at the time, it was absolute hell, but looking back, it was probably all part of growing up and being British and being an intrepid explorer and cameraman. But so at the time, it wasn't great. But I went back about 7 years ago, and I remembered all the best things about it too. The kindness of the people there, the generosity, the amazing landscapes. Yeah, it's quite an interesting country to visit.
Hmm. Well, we're now on to the final chapter, chapter 7 of your travel diaries. The top of your travel wish list. Is there a place left that you've not visited that you'd love to go to?
Well, again, I'm alone in this. I've never had a bucket list. Everywhere I've been fortunate to travel for work, I've always seen amazing things. And actually, I think probably as I get older and wiser and more boring, I don't know, I think I'd like to see more of our own country. England is, of all the countries I've visited, you know, people say to me, oh, where would you like to live? You know, and every time I've thought about it, and yes, you go to the tropics and you go to the Seychelles or New Zealand or wherever it might be, and you see these amazing things and palm trees and beautiful weather. I've always enjoyed coming home to England. It's where my family is. It's where my roots are. And I think we live in the best country in the world. Maybe not politically at the moment, but we live in the best country in the world in terms of a place to live. You know, we have amazing, we have four seasons. We have, you know, we just had snow in our garden 3 days ago. You can travel to the north and you can climb mountains. You can go down to our, you know, English Riviera to Torquay and that, you know, Devon coastline, and you can get sandy beaches and warm seas to swim in the summer. You can go for lovely country walks. You know, just 5 miles out of Bristol, I could probably choose somewhere and go for a walk today and not see anybody for half an hour, an hour.
Yeah.
We forget how amazing this country is, and I don't think I've really seen enough of it. You know, we've got some amazing wildlife. I don't know if you watch Spring Watch and Autumn Watch every year, you know, they keep that series runs and runs and runs. And, you know, there's amazing stuff. Really. Yeah. We've got so many hidden gems in England.
Yeah.
And so much yet to be discovered. So for me, England is the hidden gem on this planet. And, you know, I'm going to enjoy exploring more and more of it. And maybe as COVID continues, that'll give me the excuse to get on and do it.
I love that answer, because this summer I spent time, instead of travelling abroad as I was planning to, I spent time instead discovering what was here on my doorstep, travelling around the southwest of England. And it couldn't have been more wonderful. And as you say, I hope that we'll start to appreciate even more what we have just a few hours drive away, or even, you know, a few hours walk away.
A walk away. Yeah. Absolutely. No, I'm glad to hear that you share that sentiment.
Well, thank you, Gavin. It has been such a pleasure. Those were your incredible travel diaries. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
It's been great talking to you. Thank you.
Oh, that was a fantastic Gavin Thurston. Gavin's book, Journeys in the Wild, The Secret Life of a Cameraman, is out now. And not only is it a beautiful book to look at, it is just full of even more fabulous stories, which David Attenborough himself describes in the foreword as the written version of the visual making of. You can follow all of his adventures on Instagram at TheGavinThurston. If you've enjoyed this episode today, then don't forget to subscribe, and leaving a review or rating really helps others to discover the podcast. To find out who's joining me next week, come and follow me on Instagram. I'm at Holly Rubenstein. I'd love to hear from you. And if you can't wait until then, there's always the first three seasons to catch up on, from Michael Palin to Rick Stein and Serrano Fiennes to Simon Reeve. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll be back next week. Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn, when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away.
My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.